Welcome to Your New Mexico Government. I'm your host, Kaliole Colonna. The past few weeks has seen a rise to anti-shutdown protests in many parts of the country. Some have observed the number of weapons at some of these protests. Others have observed that most of the participants are white. That made us think, how does race factor into the conversations around reopening? Today, I talk with some of the louder voices in the state speaking out against New Mexico's shutdown and national anti-racism activist Tim Wise. And we hear from a guy who's worked for years to grapple with his own privilege. These conversations might give us a window into what the future holds. First up, executive producer Marisa DeMarco is giving us that quick COVID news update today, Friday, May 22nd, as of 5 p.m.
Trump called a surprise press conference today and announced that he was declaring houses of worship essential services, demanding that they be opened immediately. The president said he would override any governor who ordered otherwise, though it's unclear whether he actually has that authority. The CDC issued guidelines shortly afterward, according to the New York Times, saying religious centers should limit the size of gatherings in accordance with local and state orders. Here in New Mexico, state officials announced they are hiring 200 to 250 contact tracers who identify people who've tested positive for coronavirus and then help track folks they were near before they knew they were infected. It's remote work and there's a virtual hiring process, according to the Santa Fe Reporter. Head over to the State Personnel Office website at spo.state.nm.us. The state reported 160 new confirmed cases today, bringing the total here to 6,625. And most of those are either in the northwest corner of the state or in Bernalillo County. Officials also said there were 8 more deaths. The death toll stands at 302. The Navajo Nation borders Republican State Senator Bill Scherer's district, and you'll hear from him in a few minutes in this episode. The Navajo Nation said there were 181 more cases today. That's 20 more than the whole state of New Mexico, bringing the total here to 4,434. They've had about half the number of deaths as the state. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham said state flags will fly at half-mast through Memorial Day in honor of people who've died from coronavirus and their families, in addition to being a recognition of military members. For Your New Mexico Government, I'm Marisa DeMarco.
So I'm on the line now with executive producer Marisa DeMarco. Marisa, how are you?
I'm all right. How you doing, Khalil?
I'm doing well. And we just kind of wanted to break down why we decided to take on this topic and some of the guests we chose for today. Take it away.
You know, you think about your own personal decision making around leaving your house. And I gotta say, the thing that keeps me home is this idea that me going out could potentially result in harm to brown and black communities that have been disproportionately affected by the virus when it comes to fatality, when it comes to infections. We're seeing that here at home. We're seeing folks on tribal lands who are dealing with more cases per capita. Just the thought that me going out to do whatever I want to do, and I want to go out, right? Yeah. Like, I'm sure, like everybody, I miss seeing everybody. I miss doing all the things I used to do.
Yeah.
But the thought that I could be any part of a chain, you know, that keeps me in my apartment, that keeps me washing my hands, that keeps me wearing a mask, you know?
Yeah. And also, you know, we've discussed the matter of race and how that applies in COVID-19 with a new light shone upon it. One of the things we've had, everybody who's spoken about race has either been black or brown.
Right.
And it's very important, we felt it's very important, to get some white voices on to speak about race, particularly Tim Wise, who I'm very excited about that interview with. But we just kind of wanted to get an understanding from some of the people who are have a little bit of a public voice about reopening. We wanted to talk to them, hence the conversation with State Senator Scherer and Sheriff Hamilton. I think today it's going to be a very enlightening episode for people. Hopefully it motivates them into action.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that is that, you know, it shouldn't only be on black and brown people to talk about systemic racism, right? So it's important that we bring these questions to everyone, right? And
yeah, exactly.
So that's, this episode is us speaking with white folks about white privilege and reopening.
Yep. We might as well. Let's get to it.
Let's do it.
As the governor introduced the shutdown, several local politicians decided to speak out against it. One of them is Senator Bill Scherer. Senator Scherer, thanks for being with me today.
It's my pleasure. Glad to be with you.
So how are things in Farmington today?
Well, you know, what's interesting is we're one of the hot spots, but things in Farmington are fine. And that's what makes this shutdown so interesting and strange. Farmington proper, not a problem. Almost nobody knows of anybody that has the virus here. We all know of people that are unemployed, though. But it's just west of us where the hot spot really is. Certainly now our hospital, Salem Regional Medical Center, is increasing the number of COVID patients that they have. But most of those are not from Farmington.
In essence, do you think there should have been a shutdown?
I don't think so. Maybe initially we could have taken some actions because we didn't know. But as things became clear, I think we focused on the wrong thing. What we know is that the vulnerable among the population were the people in the assisted living facilities or with some other underlying medical condition. Most of that was diabetes, high blood pressure, or obesity. Mm-hmm. That's where our focus should have been. How do we protect that group of people?
If you look at Farmington and other rural parts of the state, how many folks actually are aware that they may have a compromised immune system, given the lack of available health treatments and available health checkups? There's a lot of people who may not know their exact health situation. So why put them at risk to open up a few businesses on a partial basis?
Nothing that any of us have been advocating says thou shalt go to the store. What we're advocating is a more or less level playing field. We have two Walmarts and a Sam's Club here. Mm-hmm. They are packed all the time. If you're going to get the disease, you're going to get it at Walmart or Smith's Grocery Store or Safeway or something like that, because those stores are packed all the time.
You represent an area that's been hit hardest by the state, because neighboring to Farmington, you have the Navajo Nation, where the numbers are extremely disproportionate in the rate of deaths and infection rate. Do you think rolling back the shutdown too early would result in illness and death for some of your constituents? How does that sit with you?
I don't think that's true. There's two things here. One, when Gallup completely shut down, effectively what happened was we denied access to food and water to thousands of Navajo families. And what I mean by water is there's still plenty of families out there that haul water to their homes, wherever their homes are. In Farmington, the governor actually asked both our county and our city. She wanted to close us down, but she wanted permission of the local officials. And they both said no. County and city both said no. We're not going to cut off food and water to our neighbors.
Do you not worry about the people you love in Farmington getting sick with the coronavirus? You don't worry about catching it yourself?
Well, see, that goes back to the whole concept of who's really vulnerable here. What we know is that most people, we might get it, but most of us don't even know that we got it. Plus, I'm also convinced that if you have been in any grocery store in Farmington in the last 2 months, you have been exposed. And we're all mostly still doing fine, unless you live in one of the assisted living facilities, or you have some underlying medical condition. And truly, for the Navajo population, yes, there's a lot of people that aren't in those facilities, but they still have these underlying medical conditions. That's the risk factor that we ought to be taking into account, not that they can't shop at the local bookstore.
Now, there's enough that we don't understand about this virus. I have 40 to 50 conversations a week about coronavirus and how it's impacting the state. I've spoken to several scientists and epidemiologists who say there's not enough to understand, and the fact that, quote unquote, healthy people, healthy, active people are catching the virus and dying. That kind of dispels the notion that only the vulnerable we should be concerned about.
All I have to do is look at the daily body count that the governor puts out. And if you look at the daily body count from San Juan County, rarely is there anybody under 60 years old. Not that it doesn't happen, mm-hmm. but it's rare. 63% of all of the deaths in San Juan County, and there's been 99 of them now, 63% come from two assisted living facilities. To me, that's a pretty clear statistic.
When politicians are talking about the shutdown, it's a balance of economy and business. That's versus health and human lives. Now, people seem to be against the shutdown. It seems like they're prioritizing money over people's lives, especially the lives of brown and black people, who has shown that it disproportionately affects. What is different in how you see that issue?
First of all, I reject that notion completely. I believe that New Mexicans are quite capable of protecting grandma and mom and pop shops at the same time. It's not an either or. We don't have to pick grandma's death to save our shop, and we don't have to pick the death of our shop to save grandma. We can do both.
Well, how do we do
that?
It's
simply a matter of knowing where the vulnerable are, and I think we've already talked about that. The vulnerable aren't spread out all across the population. The vulnerable are in some small groups.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you for the discussion. Hopefully, we can have you on in the future to talk about how nature is changing in Farmington and across the state.
Okay, thanks.
Wonderful. That's Senator Bill Scherer. My next guest is one of America's leading anti-racism activists and scholars. He's the author of best-selling books like White Like Me, Dear White America, and Under the Affluence. I'd like to welcome Tim Wise to the show. Tim Wise, thanks for being with me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You've said that black and brown people know what it's like to be looked at by white people as carrying some sort of contagion, and that white folks aren't used to being viewed as potential carriers of something awful in regards to COVID-19 and the response we're getting socially. Explain that a little bit further.
Yeah, the thought that I had when this whole thing started, what was so fascinating was that, this resistance that so many white Americans have manifested to masking and keeping social distance and being seen as possibly, carrying a virus that could kill you into a store or into a public space. White people many of us seem horribly aggrieved at the suggestion that we could be dangerous. That's the kind of stuff that black and brown folks are thinking about every day. Maybe white folks now could sit back and go,
Is that a matter of white privilege?
I think it's a matter of white supremacy and the privilege that comes with that, specifically the privilege of not being the one who is under suspicion, the one who, is never viewed as carrying the contagion for the most part. It's the privilege of feeling like you can go anywhere you want to go. I mean, think about, the sort of stunning lack of perspective on the part of some of these anti-lockdown protesters who are overwhelmingly white people. And it's sort of interesting, right? Because if you look at who are the people who are disproportionately out of work as a result of this thing, it's hitting people of color the hardest. It's hitting a working class and lower income folks of all colors the hardest. But who were the folks showing up in the camo with the guns and doing these demonstrations in Michigan and Ohio and all of these states? It's not a bunch of poor folks of whatever color. It's not black and brown folks for the most part. I mean, there are a few, but it's mostly white, mostly middle class and above, who are not even the ones being hit the hardest, demanding the right to go get a haircut. And they're even analogizing. You'll hear them analogize the social distancing measures to slavery, yeah, to lynching, to Nazi concentration camps.
Now, in your opinion, why do some white people resist that acknowledgement of understanding the insulation of their privilege?
Well, I mean, obviously, to acknowledge that one has unearned advantage and privilege sort of puts you on the hook, as James Baldwin said, notably, right, that white people don't want to confront the truth about our society, because then we're on the hook to do something about it. The fact is, most people, regardless of race, are pretty decent people. Most human beings are good, caring, kind, compassionate people. The problem is, when you're a good, kind, caring, compassionate person, you have a real vested psychological interest in not acknowledging when other people are in pain. Because if you're a good person and you see that somebody's in pain, you're like morally obligated to intervene, right? So it's easier to just stay in denial.
Yeah, I've had conversations with friends, white friends, who would come up to me over the years, and they would want to talk about white privilege and talk about the issues of race with me. And I got to a point where I stopped having those conversations with them. I told them as soon as they began, I would turn them around and say, have this conversation with your white friends, your white family, because I already know from my experiences of being an African-American man at 46 years old. Now, some of them have gone on to say, I want to use my privilege for good. I will use my privilege. But my retort is, release your privilege. How do you feel about what can be done to get people to understand, not just white people, anyone who has privilege, a man who has privilege, certain the wealthy who act within certain privilege, so we can release the idea of privilege and then begin to work? What is needed to do that?
the idea that one can relinquish one's privilege in a society that continually shovels it to you is probably a bit naive. Like, we can't really do it. What we mean, and this is what I would guess you're probably thinking of too when you tell your friends that, is it's not enough to use your privilege for good unless what you mean by that is that you're going to work actively for the destruction of a society and system, or a system that produces it in the first place.
What are some questions for white people to ask themselves when it comes to racism and inequality within the country? Where do they go to get a deeper understanding of their views?
Well, I think the first and foremost question that we always ought to start with is, you know, who is in the best position to determine whether or not a systemic inequality and mistreatment are happening? Is it the person to whom it's happening or the person to whom it isn't happening? You know, I always use the thought experiment. If I ask any white person in America right now, hey, do you think that things were equal for black folks in 1963 or 1962? No matter your politics, if even you could be a very conservative white person today, and you're still going to say, no, of course not, right? Because everybody knows. You don't have to know history that well, right, to know that, like, that's the middle of the civil rights movement. Of course it wasn't equal. But what's interesting is you go back and you read those Gallup polls, right, and 2 out of 3 white people in 1963 told Gallup that black people had equal opportunity. In retrospect, that's absurd. But at the time, white people who were every bit as rational, every bit as functional as white people are today, completely believed that. Obviously, white people were really, really wrong when they said that. And black folks who were like, yeah, no, it's not quite that way, were right. Now, what happened in the last half century? Did white people suddenly become super perceptive? And now we understand the way the world works. And black folks who had totally correct 50 years ago or so, 60 years ago, lost their minds and they can't determine their own reality anymore? Come on. Nothing changed, right? The reality is when you're in the system of oppression, you're the one who knows when it's happening. And if you're not in the system, you don't have to see it. So the obliviousness is very dangerous, but it's a privilege that we've had from the beginning of the country.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on with me. Thank you for your insight. Hopefully in the future, we can talk again.
I would love that.
This is Your NM Government. I'm your host, Khalil A. Colonna. We're covering the way the virus and health measures are impacting people differently around the state. Along with the slow reopening of the state, we've shifted our broadcast to 3 days a week. Tune in Wednesday through Friday at 7:30 p.m. here on KUNM, or find the episode anywhere you get your podcasts. How are race and white privilege affecting you in the time of the pandemic? Have you decided to engage in conversations about the systemic problems we face here in America? What are you willing to do? We want to hear your experiences. Call up our hotline, leave a message, and we'll interview you. Call 505-218-7084 or email yournmgov@gmail.com. My next guest is Sierra County Sheriff Glenn Hamilton. Sheriff Hamilton, thanks for being with me today.
Hey, thank you for having me on, Khalil.
Let me ask you, you've been critical of the governor and the shutdown order. Why exactly?
I guess my criticism mainly of the governor and her staff. And, you know, when you have a response to a particular situation, it needs to be proportionate to the actual threat. And I've said this in many venues and in many interviews, that I'm not saying that corona is not impactful to New Mexico and that it has not been a serious situation for portions of our state. So my criticism of the governor is that she is treating the entire state as if we were Bernalillo County, Sandoval County, San Juan County, and McKinley County.
Hmm. Now, you just recently deputized a church congregation in early this month. I want to talk to you about that. What was your logic and thinking behind that?
In phase 3 of my emergency response plan, there was a provision in there where I would rely on citizen volunteers. Now, I was contacted early by members of one of the churches here, the New Hope Church, and said, Sheriff, you know, if you need any help from us. They came to me first, but subsequently then started deputizing other volunteers and inviting the rest of the community to come in, saying that, look, I've got to get out in front of this. Sierra County had its first case. I was now in phase 2, and I would be derelict in my responsibilities here if I didn't start planning to go into phase 3.
It's been said that this is possibly a way to become exempt, because under the law, the governor's law enforcement is exempted from her order. You were quoted as saying, "Believe me, folks, that is not my intent." But was that really the intent? We don't see a rise in the numbers in Sierra County. Why have 80 people as deputies?
So when I issued special deputy appointments, they're immediately issued in an inactive form. It specifically says on the form itself, this individual has no authority, no powers granted to them until such time as called up to duty by the sheriff. So as we saw with even the pastor of the church, when he received the cease and desist order from the state police, and he said, so the deputization that I got from the sheriff, that didn't mean anything? And the officer said, absolutely not.
Okay. But let me ask you this. According to the census, Sierra County is mostly white. And we're seeing that across the country, the coronavirus is really affecting black and brown communities. Here specifically in the state, it's impacting Native communities. When we have one area of the state actively pushing for a reopening, when other areas of the state are disproportionately affected, what does that look like in your mind?
We have no information whatsoever as to why it affects disproportionately those specific communities as opposed to
it's pretty clear
communities
with,
like ours.
With a history.
I mean, again, I don't know if it's a culture. Perhaps because of the Native Americans there, they have a totally different culture than what we have here in Sierra County.
They do live differently than us, but it's pretty obvious fact, and it's stated that the healthcare system for black and brown communities, as well as Native Americans, are not even close to that which is in mostly white areas. We understand that's a system of the country.
Welcome to Sierra County.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, we have a very inadequate healthcare system here. This is rural New Mexico. You know, folks that have to travel hundreds of miles just to come down here, and we don't even have an urgent care facility in our ER. Anybody that even breaks a bone has to be shipped off to Las Cruces or Albuquerque.
Given that there's little resources, why would the people of Sierra County want to open up? What happens if there is a major outbreak?
That's why we're not looking at doing this irresponsibly. We're not looking at saying, we just want to be opened up and let's let down all the barricades and bring them on in, because we know that could potentially devastate the ability for our health care providers that we do have in order to adequately deal with that. So again, we're asking and we are demanding, trying to work with the governor for a responsible opening down here. Again, that's why we're not looking and not pushing for a 100% opening. We want this gradual opening, especially in these areas that have not had the impact that Northwest New Mexico has had.
Okay, I want to thank you again very much for your time. He is Sierra County Sheriff Glenn Hamilton. Sheriff Hamilton, thanks again.
Camille, thank you.
Next up, an interview with a construction project manager in northern New Mexico, a white man who says he's come a long way in his personal understanding of race and privilege. He spoke with KUNM News Director Hannah Colton.
I'm Scott Davis. I'm 51. I grew up on the West Coast, came to New Mexico in 2007, working for a Native woman-owned construction firm, Avanya General Contracting. Currently, I'm project manager for the Okeawinge Housing Authority.
Most white folks were not raised to delve into how whiteness gives us privilege, gives us access to resources that are taken from people of color. They don't teach that stuff in school.
No.
So what prompted you to start learning, and what was that learning process like?
You know, it was through relationship and conversation. When I came to New Mexico, I was in a pretty bad way. Family was split up, financial difficulties, couldn't see my kids, all kinds of stuff. And I came here very broken, and people embraced me. You know, nobody gave me a pass, but they also recognized the pain I was in and gave me space to feel that and to heal. And through that process, I was in a lot of conversations with a lot of people around what these things mean. They were terms to me prior to coming to New Mexico, but they became ideas and concepts and realities as I was in relationship, particularly with Native women, who were saying, hey, you know, you're a white man. That has meaning. And, you know, my initial response was, get out of here with that. Come on. I'm just Scott. Don't discriminate against me. I mean, I've said it, you know. And luckily for me, a lot of these folks took the time to lean in and say, you know, actually, you're smarter than that. So I want you to think about this. I want you to read about this. come back in a month and let's have another conversation. Do a little homework.
We're talking about on this show, you know, all the ways that saving lives during the pandemic really becomes an anti-racism project. What's your advice to white people who are wanting to help, wanting to get involved in anti-racism work, but don't know even what that would look like?
I would say the first thing is get on the internet and read Black women, Indigenous women, trans folks, you know, and keep doing that. Like it's not something that you ever stop doing. I'm constantly looking for new voices to learn from. The next step I would say is to show up. And showing up is actually so much easier than I think a lot of white folks think. Because if you do start reading and you do start listening to the voices of marginalized people, you will find that there's a whole lot of actions and events going on out there. I mean, in the COVID era, a lot of it is online, but it's still happening. There's free webinars, there's all this stuff. And show up, go, listen, learn, meet people, start building relationships with folks that you normally wouldn't have. Don't go with an agenda to help these people, because that's not our place as white folks. You know,
a lot of it is getting on board with a lot of efforts that are already underway and need kinds of support that are maybe not so sexy.
Exactly. I like to think of it like doing the dishes, you know, go to the party and do the dishes, stay late. So what? They're blowing out the candles in the other room. Do the dishes. We got to get out of the limelight. We got to get doing that work that has been typically done by people of color, by women, by Indigenous folks, in the background, and be good with that. Eventually, you know, folks are going to notice you and bring you closer into conversations. But that's the thing, is that instead of coming in as a leader in the movement, you come in as a member of the community. And there's a huge difference there. I think so much of it is about humility, honestly. We don't even notice our arrogance. Because so many of us have been taught that the way to get things done is to move to the front of the class, get to the head of the line, make sure people are listening. And that is contrary to what it will take for collective liberation. And we got to find our place in the circle instead of trying to push to the front of the line.
I think an important point that you're getting to is that this is really relational work. It's really messy. You're not going to know how to do it. Like what are ways that people have let you know that you are, you know, stepping on toes or crossing lines? Like, are there times that you were held accountable and had to sort of step back and reevaluate?
Yeah. Like more times than I can really remember or recount. It's ongoing. The thing that I think is so wonderful about this work for me personally is that the relationships I have today compared to the relationships I had 10 years ago feels so much deeper and caring and loving and nurturing. And those are people that are willing to take the risk to tell me, hey, Scott, that was messed up. I need you to think about that. Go do some homework, asking hard questions and pointing to places where I've made a mistake.
What are actions that people who have privilege right now can take that could help in this time of pandemic and beyond?
Yeah. The first thing when we talk about pandemic, stay home if you can. Wear your damn mask. It's really not that hard. And you're saving lives when you do it. If you have resources that you can spare, who could use them? And understand what the word "you can spare" means. Then go a little deeper. What can you go without?
As you're seeing anti-shutdown protests across the country, how are you thinking about the link between white privilege and entitlement and these sort of pushbacks against public health orders?
The privilege of being a white, especially a white straight cisgendered man in America, is immense. And when you're steeped and raised in privilege, you learn entitlement. So coming from that lens, why wouldn't I be entitled to walk around without a mask? Why wouldn't I be entitled to go get an ice cream cone whenever I want to? And so they're pushing back against it. And I think it comes from entitlement, plain and simple. This is not about the government wanting to tell you that you can't be a free person. This is about saving lives.
Scott, if white people are hearing your words and they want to learn more, how can they find you or the groups you work with?
they can email me at scottdavis1117@gmail.com. That's probably the best way to get in touch with me. Also, check out Organizing White Men for Collective Liberation. It's OWMCL.org. Our acronym is so horrible that it's actually pretty cool.
Scott Davis, thank you so much for taking the time today. This has been great.
Thank you, Hannah. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's Friday, and it's about that time for resources. Find a full list of the resources we talk about on each episode and opportunities to donate or help online at bit.ly/YNMGHub. If you want to hear more from Tim Wise or check out one of his books, head to timwise.org. Check out SURJ, Showing Up for Racial Justice. It's a multiracial network of people organizing white folks for racial and social justice. Check out what the local chapter is doing at the Facebook page, SURJABQ. The Albuquerque Friends Meeting, the local Quaker organization, has a whiteness study group, and they've got resources on building anti-racist multicultural faith communities. It's abqfriends.org, examining-whiteness. The Santa Fe Community Foundation has a whole course on unlearning racism and understanding privilege. Head to our post on KUNM.org for that. And there's a great podcast series called Seeing White that takes a deep dive into the history of whiteness in America and its violent legacy through to today. Find that link on the podcast on the show page. That's seenonradio.org/seeing-white. Hear us Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays on KUNM's airwaves at 7:30 p.m. online. You can find the show on KUNM.org or subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. Your New Mexico Government is a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage is provided in part by the Thornburg Foundation, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, the New Mexico Local News Fund, and KUNM listeners like you. Your New Mexico Government is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco, theme music by Pope Yes Yes Y'all. It's produced by yours truly, News Update by Marisa DeMarco. Thanks to Hannah Colton for her contributions, and special thanks to Ty Bannerman for helping out to edit these long conversations we had today. You rock, my man. I'm Khalil A. Colonna. For everyone here at Your New Mexico Government, have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.